Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Adam Boyd on behalf of the appellants. This case presents the central question of whether the doctrine of consular non-reviewability can shield the State Department from any claim, even where there is a well-pled allegation of a State Department policy that violates the clear statutory text of the INA that creates a clear burden-shifting scheme when it relates to a specific trig inadmissibility. It does not. While that doctrine is expansive, when plaintiffs bring forward a challenge to a generic policy rather than individual consular officer determinations, the court still maintains the power to tell the State Department that it needs to change its course going forward.
Counsel, doesn't your request for relief, the prayer for relief in this case, request redetermination of individual decisions?
So our request, there were multiple requests in both the first complaint and the second complaint. What we're ultimately seeking is an opportunity to reapply for these visas and go through a process that follows what the INA requires. These individuals are entitled to an opportunity to present evidence that they are not subject to the trig ground of inadmissibility, and they were never given that opportunity. So we concede that the court doesn't have jurisdiction to say that the consular officers need to revisit these prior decisions. What we ask for is that they be given an opportunity to reapply without the taint of these prior denials in their record.
I'm having some trouble with that because I don't think there's a constitutional claim. Let's talk about the individual visa applicants. Do you agree with that?
Yes, we explicitly waive the constitutional arguments on
appeal. So now we're on to basically an APA type claim. And I'm still having trouble getting my head around why that would not be barred by consular non-reviewability.
So in essence, the doctrine of consular non-reviewability prevents courts from looking at individual visa officers' determinations about inadmissibility, but it doesn't prevent the court from looking at whether or not the State Department is following the law in the precursors to those decisions. So it is a little bit chicken and the egg in terms of you could wind up with almost identical decisions from consular officers so long as they follow a policy that allows individuals to present evidence. So the content of the decisions may not change so long as they're given the process.
If they've been through the visa request process, application process, what you want this court to order is they get another chance without the taint of prior rulings?
That's part of the prospective relief that we're seeking, but what we're ultimately seeking is that the State Department develop a policy that follows the INA's rules that allow for individuals to present evidence about their mental state when there's Tier 3 trig allegations.
I don't know if your research took you in this direction, but our court has been wrestling recently with a separate statute dealing with temporary protected status. And the United States Supreme Court has now made very clear that APA concerns don't discharge temporary, meaning temporary. So this statute says non-review. How does wouldn't we be flying in the face of Supreme Court precedent to say that either the INA or the APA has some constraint on non-reviewability?
So with respect to the Supreme Court's decision, I would note that they explicitly left McNary untouched, which allows for a policy type challenge, even in the context of the TPS program. And so to the extent that you're worried about the court's ability to review this, it's not really implicated by the Supreme Court's recent decision.
What we worry about is getting smacked down by our seniors. So
I understand.
You've elicited a path that may provide some circumstance.
There's also a distinct difference between the TPS statute, which provides for, at the end, complete and total discretion, whereas what we're talking about is implementation of the inadmissibility grounds that don't contain you can make this decision in your sole and complete discretion based off of trig. And because...
Well, you think there's a difference between sole and complete discretion and non-reviewability?
Well, not entirely. I think that the non-reviewability comes from the sole and complete discretion, which is why we have the doctrine and we don't look at the underlying consular officer's decisions. The reason that we have the consular officer's decisions presented in this case is because they demonstrate the antecedent policy. We show that they're citing the trig-related grounds of inadmissibility in their refusals, and that means that we know that that is where they're going with their decision-making, and so we can build it backwards to find out that the process was not followed, because some of our plaintiffs were interviewed before the 2019 designation and received their denials afterwards. It's clear they didn't get an opportunity to present evidence whether or not they had the requisite knowledge that the IRGC would be considered a Tier 3 terrorist organization. Most of our plaintiffs never had an opportunity to present documentation. When you're going through the visa process, there's a limited number of documents you can upload to the Department of State website. And so if there is the specter of trig, there needs to be some mechanism for people to present additional documents to counteract.
Boy, that sounds pretty granular to me in terms of the consular process. So maybe I'm having trouble. What is the specific... kind of, if I'll call it, class-wide relief that you would ask us to grant?
So we never got into specific relief at this stage because the district court granted the government's motion to dismiss. The relief that we would seek is some mechanism to submit these documents to the consular office before a final decision is made.
So what is the policy then or manual guidance that you specifically challenge?
So that's the other reason why it's premature at this stage to grant the motion to dismiss, is because the government has all of those documents. What we have is State Department employees saying that they've never seen a grant post 2019 designation, even for pre-2019 conduct. We have plaintiffs who are telling us what their process was, and we have CBP determinations where all the questioning is about IRGC activities and then a denial based on purported immigrant intent.
Yeah, and I'm still left a little uncertain and up in the air because sure. I understand you're trying to parse this by not having the consular non-reviewability cut things off. But everything you describe relates to a process, as I understand, that leads up to the visa denial or grant.
Correct.
So I'm still having some trouble, so help me out.
Sure.
How do you get past this longstanding doctrine?
The conflict that you're describing, Judge McEwen, is because our legal system requires a legal controversy. And in order to show that there is a policy that's violating the INA, we have to use the facts of what has happened in the past. And so we bring forward these plaintiffs showing that they were not given the proper process in order to show that we need to develop a process for them.
But that sounds more like you have a constitutional claim, which you expressly waived.
So the constitutional claims is whether or not the visa applicants themselves or their family members have a constitutional claim to review of the visa denials. So this court, has gone a little bit back and forth on whether or not there is any kind of review. So if there is a constitutional claim, the department needs to show at least a reasonable justification or a reasonable, I can't remember the exact language because we waived those claims. We're not seeking the justification redetermination of any of these visas at this point in time. We think that that is foreclosed by the court's decision in Munoz, reversing this court's decision. And so that's why we're not pursuing it as a constitutional matter, but rather as unreasonable agency action, unreasonable agency policymaking.
Well, I think okay, there's still... Did I interrupt you?
Go ahead. Well, I just... What is the INA section or the Foreign Affairs Manual that's violated by the policy?
So it's the INA is violated by the policy because the INA says, you know, there are different tiers of inadmissibility. And if it's not an officially designated terrorist organization, then in order to be inadmissible, the person who allegedly engaged with or was a member of the terrorist organization had to have known or reasonably should have known that their actions would be considered, you know, in support of a terrorist organization, or more, that they're, that they should have known or reasonably known that it was a terrorist organization.
And well, you have, I know, different people or potential clients situated in different times, like when their application was processed, when certain things happened, when law changed. But is there anything in the INA that requires this process that you're asking us to send back so it might be implemented?
So the actual language of the inadmissibility statute itself contemplates an ability to present evidence related to mental state, which is different than most grounds of inadmissibility, which are triggered by concrete actions in time or place or reason to believe where there is some evidence of underlying inadmissibility. In this case, because there is a mental state that inheres in the inadmissibility ground, there needs to be some documentation about whether that exists. And to resolve that question, none of the applicants were asked about their mental state or given an opportunity to explain. And so it's clear that in making these inadmissibility determinations, the consular officers were not following what the INA said, because they aren't asking about what was the conduct of their service.
Well, I know Judge Kristen had a question.
Yeah, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, so I see I'm coming up on that, but I'm happy
to answer
your question.
I think I know somebody who can give you more time.
Okay, right. I appreciate that.
That's fine. I share many of Judge McEwen's concerns, but I'm going to spot you for purposes of our time that I think the recent Supreme Court decision regarding TPS, I share Judge Hawkins's view, that's very tough for you.
Understand.
I appreciate the carve out of McNary. I think the D.C. Circuit thinks there's still a path. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty skinny path.
Yeah.
And the statute we're talking about here, of course, is not TPS, and it has the language in it that Judge McEwen has just been so carefully reviewing with you, right, about non-reviewable. I think both my colleagues
correct.
Did, okay. But I'm going to come back to where I started, because you have this prayer for relief that I jumped on right away, because it sure looks like you're looking for individual determinations. And you've answered that question, I think. But I think you've answered it a couple different ways, and now I'm maybe even at a greater loss, because I think in part you seem to be looking for discovery. You're circumstantially inferring or deducing that there must be a policy out there, because you're going with what you've got, right? Just at the back end of what questions are being asked or not asked, I think. And I appreciate that. But you also said in response to Judge McEwen's first question that you wanted an order requiring a policy. And that almost sounded like affirmative injunctive relief. So is it your content here? So here's my question. I realize that's a big lead up, but I'm trying to figure out really what you're looking for. Is it your contention there is a policy and you need to get at it? Or are you requiring that they develop a policy and that this really should not be sole and unreviewable because of the nature of the statutory criteria?
It's both, actually. So we're alleging that there is a policy, and we're in this position of having to do that without full discovery because our case was dismissed.
Okay, I appreciate that, but I'm going to interrupt. So as to that, do you have anything that tells you there is a policy, or are you inferring that there must be?
So we have the affidavits from former State Department officers.
Those. Yes.
And then we have the applicant's own experience. And so we're inferring there's a policy, which is all we can do.
All right. So from that, I understand that you're inferring, and you've confirmed that. Thank you. And then you were going to say as to the other,
to the extent that there is a policy, we ask that it be overturned and that there be some process for people to submit evidence when this ground of inadmissibility is coming up at the visa stage.
Okay. Thank you for your patience with my question.
All right. I will reserve
Hawkins is good, so
my
we'll...
35 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
He may give you a little more.
All right. Yeah. I do want to talk about the CBP defendants as well.
Well, you're going to have to speak quickly when you come back.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Come on up, counsel.
(Clears
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Victoria Tercios on behalf of the government. This case involves former members of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, an organization which has been designated as a foreign terrorist organization since April of 2019. All of the former IRGC members in this case were denied admission by the executive, either through a consular officer or through a CBP agent. The appellants have characterized their case as a programmatic challenge, but their case is most accurately described as one seeking more information about the executive's decision to refuse them entry or admission.
Could I first ask you for your position on setting aside the complaint you've got for a minute, just sort of hypothetically? I'm just interested in your position about whether there's a path for a programmatic challenge.
No, Your Honor, there's no path for a programmatic challenge. And I believe Judge McEwen already got us there a little bit. First, I would cite to the Ninth Circuit's unpublished decision in Capistrano, where a policy challenge was already presented to the circuit court, and the court said that in order to analyze the policy, it would have to review the consular officer's decisions, and the entire case falls apart under the doctrine.
Okay, so again, we're not talking about he's really clear. He's not talking about individual decisions, and I think there's the complaint is less than clear on that point, in my view. But again, setting it aside, is the government's answer that there's no path for a programmatic review of this particular statute, or are you swinging broader than that?
Broader than that. It's both. First, I think I have to discuss the problems with the pleadings in this case, and then we can discuss.
I don't want to discuss the problems with pleadings in this case. I'm trying to figure out whether you're walking us into a circuit split with the D.C. Circuit. So that's why I really want to know whether you're swinging more broadly.
In Allen, on the very last page of Allen, this court said that the APA does not provide an avenue for review of a consular officer's adjudication of a consular, adjudication of a visa. I think that's very broad.
Yeah, but that could easily be talking about an individual determination, and I'm definitely not pushing back on that. My question really goes to, is there any path available for a programmatic review?
I don't think there is, Your Honor, because of the way that the general rule for consular non-reviewability functions. We have repeatedly said, not just in this circuit, the Supreme Court has said there are only two exceptions, when Congress said so or under the Constitution. So I think the only way is if a constitutional claim had been brought, maybe we would fall into the bad faith exception.
Okay, so your response makes sense to me if we're talking about this statute, and I suppose we don't really have to be talking about any other statutes,
yeah,
because that's the one present in this case. But I just wanted to be clear on the government's position, so thank you for that.
So I turn back to this case in particular, that it's very important to discuss again the specific refusal ground that was cited in each of the visa applications in this case, because it's so important. The specific ground cited was 8 U.S.C. 1182A3B. That's a general citation for the terrorism-related inadmissibility grounds, or TRIG. And ordinarily, Your Honors, when a consular officer refuses a visa, that officer is required to provide a more specific ground of inadmissibility as a basis for refusal. That requirement is at 1182B1. However, that requirement, B1, does not apply when the consular officer refuses a visa under the TRIG. That is located at 8 U.S.C. 1182B3. The Supreme Court has recently acknowledged that lack of obligation in its decision in Munoz, where the visa applicant in that case was also refused under 1182A3B. The Supreme Court said, actually, that the statute was more procedure, more explanation than the visa applicant was required, or was entitled. The same is true here. So because the consular officers cited only 1182A3B, that essentially ends this alleged policy challenge in this case. The government has never conceded that the consular officers found the more specific inadmissibility grounds that the appellants have suggested were found by the consular officers. That the idea that a more specific ground based on knowledge or intent was found is an assumption only. And the same is true of the declarations that were attached to the complaints. They are
also different sections or subsections. Some require this intent and others don't, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So I'm trying to understand their claim, as they would say, well, we're not asking for a review of the individuals, but we believe that the policy is such that they were not given a full opportunity to put forward some of this information about knowledge or intent. But of course, then you'd have to figure out what section they were charged under. And in my view, it kind of took us right back to the individual review. But they say, no, if we can get discovery and we can get the policy, then we can challenge it wholesale. What's wrong with that?
Yes. Maybe your question is linked to Judge Kristen's question from earlier. I know you mentioned the D.C. Circuit. I believe you're referring to the Peterson case. I think the Peterson case is materially distinct from this case because that case involved an inadmissibility determination, a very specific inadmissibility determination under fraud or willful misrepresentation. Here, the ground is general. There are factual predicates that must be found by the consular officer, but that was a specific inadmissibility citation, and the plaintiff had also alleged the specific section of the Foreign Affairs Manual that was supposedly inconsistent with the government's application or when it found inadmissibility for fraud or misrepresentation. That's not the case here.
Exactly, and no. That's why we were trying to be, I think both of us were trying to be very what clear is the about claim. How broadly yeah. you're swinging. Mm-hmm. And we only have one case in front of us, but I think it does matter exactly what we're talking about. And, hence our, actually all three of us have asked these questions about exactly what your position is. I don't think it's correct that there is no path. I certainly agree it's awfully skinny. But that's what I'm trying to be careful about.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I'll sum up very quickly with the visa applicants unless there are any other questions on this point. But essentially because the plaintiff's case requires the government to review the consular officer's decisions in this case, the doctrine does apply. As to the Canadian...
Now let's look at the complaint that we've got and pretend that it's going to be amended and that request for a redo for individual determinations is excised. Let's excise that for a minute. What would it take on this statute to make a policy level challenge? We don't have a constitutional claim.
On this statute, the yes. general statute.
Yes, and he doesn't have a policy, as in that other case or in Ramos, we had congressional testimony about how a particular statute was being applied. We don't have that here.
I think it's impossible for the plaintiffs to amend their complaint to assert a policy challenge on this statute. They haven't identified, and I know that policy challenges happen all the time, that plaintiffs successfully bring policy challenges on unnamed policies. Here, there's no identification of the policy. There's an assumption of the more specific ground. There's no identification of who implemented or created the policy. There are several issues that would need to be found in order to amend the complaint successfully.
So we need discovery, but they also have this very, very tough statutory language. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And on discovery, Your Honor, I would say that there can't be discovery in this case because it's mere conclusions.
Yeah, I was doing my hypothetical.
Okay.
Uh-huh. One moment, because I think I cut off Judge McHugh, and I didn't mean to. Judge Hawkins, anything further? Okay.
So I would turn very quickly to the Canadian applicants, that the district court correctly determined that the plaintiffs had failed to state a claim for some of the reasons that I just explained, that there was no identification of the actual policy, no identification of who was in charge of having created or implemented the policy. And then there were some separate alternative findings made by the court. If there are no questions on the Canadian applicants, then the government would rest on its papers and ask the court to affirm dismissal of this case.
I don't think we do have additional questions. Thank you for your argument,
Thank
counsel.
You.
Thank you again. My colleague points to the central issue in this case. We claim that there's a policy, and they claim that there's not a policy. when we're talking about a motion to dismiss, those differences should be resolved in our favor because the government is the garter of the policy in this case. We have no information. Unlike Peterson, there's no published FAM decision saying this is what you have to do. But we know that this is happening behind the scenes. We've done everything we can, short of discovery, to prove that this policy exists. And when dismissing the case before final discovery, before any discovery has been conducted, the district court erred in not drawing those inferences in our favor.
And would you just restate for us the purported policy that you're challenging?
So the purported policy is that anybody who served in the IRGC, mandatory service, even pre-designation in 2019, is deemed inadmissible based on the terrorism-related grounds of inadmissibility, more broadly, as cited by my colleague, and that that's inappropriate for pre-2019 service. So there's a categorical policy to deny anybody who has served in the IRGC at any time, and that doesn't comport with the statute as it relates to pre-designation activities. With respect to the Canadian applicants, extending the doctrine of consular non-reviewability to CBP officers' determinations of inadmissibility is a step too far. And saying that our claims are barred as it relates to the Canadian applicants was clear error on behalf of the district court.
Why aren't they barred by Section 1252?
I agree with you that challenging the individual removal order in the case of one of our applicants is barred by the jurisdiction stripping provisions, and we're not trying to challenge that. What we're trying, again, this goes back to process versus individual determinations, but saying that we're barred based on the doctrine of consular non-reviewability for CBP process is not something that courts have generally said. They have lots of discretion, but not the same as a State Department consular officer.
I just want to also, a few other loose ends here. This applicant, Sabhi, he's not included or not requested as put
We're not requesting reversal of the removal order because that is clearly barred through statute, and I don't think that the court has power to reverse that.
All right, I just wanted to double check
factual.
Thank you.
Anything further?
In a time of unprecedented executive overreach, often under the guise of national security claims, big scary words like terrorism, it's up to the courts to be the bulwark against some of this overreach. We have Congress telling the executive how they're supposed to make these determinations, and they're doing whatever they want. And the executive comes up here and says, doesn't matter what we do, there's no pathway to bring a challenge to that because foreign affairs, because State Department. That's not right. All we're seeking is discovery and a means for some of these people who their only crime was swimming. Their IRGC membership included swimming. That was it.
Counsel.
And he wants to visit.
Counsel, you're way all over time. Could you please wrap up?
Yes. We just seek a process for these people to visit their families in the United States. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. It's an important case. We'll take good care of it and give it our best shot and get you a decision as soon as we can.
Thank you very much.
We'll stand in recess for the day.